And we have both parties here. So good morning again to everyone in the courtroom. We are here in the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 23rd, and we have six cases. This is the second case scheduled for oral argument today. My name is Sarah Wheelock, and I'm the presiding judge. I'm here with Judges Lucinda Jessen and Peter Reyes. The oral arguments will be recorded by the court, and the audio should be available on the website for the judicial branch within 24 hours. Marshall, please call the second case before us this morning.
This is case number A220052, Sunlight Senior Living 1, LLC, appellant, versus Sunlight Senior Living Incorporated at all respondents, Sunlight Services, LLC, respondent, Peaceful Lodge Incorporated at all respondents, Sue Lee, respondent.
So, counsel, as you probably know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant has an additional 5 minutes. It's my understanding that there are three different attorneys representing the multiple parties that are here on behalf of various respondents, and that the time will be split evenly between each of you, 5 minutes per arguing counsel. And so with that, we will reset the clock for 5 minutes for each of you and afford you time to switch who goes up to the podium. There is a clock on the podium in the center if you wish to argue there. And if not, there are podiums on the side. It's just not as easy to see the clock. So I'll just ask each counsel to introduce yourself before you begin and name the party that you represent so that our recording is clear. So counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, Counsel. Peter Gleeklin, Larson King, on behalf of the appellant Sunlight Senior Living Roman One LLC. Your Honors, there's a whole host of issues that have been implicated by the district court's two orders. It's September order and it's November order that have been implicated on this appeal. But the overriding issue here is it's relatively clear from both of these orders that the district court was, its orders were result driven. That the district court was persuaded by the respondents' jury arguments. And once the district court arrived at its results, it then backfilled. It then attempted to rationalize its opinions. But in doing so, the district court mischaracterized facts and misapplied the law. It did not, as it was obligated to do, view the evidence in the light most favorable to my client and failed to allow a jury to come to reasonable inferences from those facts. In essence, the district court substituted itself for a jury. Now, there are a number of issues here, as I said, and I don't think 15 minutes is going to be sufficient time to address every one. But what I want to do is I first want to look at some of the facts because I think it's very important for us to understand the relationship, the affiliations between the respondents in this case, apart from accusations that were thrown at.
Counsel, if I may, because our time is short here.
Yes.
You know, and before going into all the facts, and we've read all of this, but you know, you said that the district court mischaracterized facts. Could you just tell us what were the facts in the district court's order, I've got it here, that you believe are mischaracterized?
Well, I believe that the court, while mischaracterizing, not appreciating the ties, the affiliations between all of these respondents that predated the purchase agreement at issue here. You have Cy Tao and Li Vang, who are the owners of the sellers, husband and wife. They received $17 million in this transaction. You have Ms. Bao Vang, who's more than just the sister of Li Vang. The district court did not note, in at least in its orders, that what the evidence showed was that Bao Vang first got into the waiver program senior living business.
Mr. Giegel, how is that relevant? I mean, how is that material? I mean, you're right. The district judge didn't say that. But, you know, if whether or not they're seller affiliates, doesn't that kind of still come back to the, you know, did they have knowledge of that provision? You know, if we're looking at, for example, kind of the tortious interference contract, if you could just tell me where the district court mischaracterized a fact and how it related to one of the legal issues.
Well, the court did mischaracterize the fact that upon service of the complaint, Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge had knowledge of the restrictive covenants from the complaint, but then mischaracterized without any cite, claiming that that receipt of that information did not constitute notice. That the testimony in this case, if I'm going to try a case, Your Honor, we're going to have facts that go to the heart of the issues, and we're also going to have credibility issues that bear on those issues. And you have Bao Vang and Li Vang that testified differently. Bao Vang testified that she educated Li Vang as to the way this business is run, how it's done. Li Vang testified her sister never had any input.
Even though they're sisters, weren't they competitors?
Well, that begs the question. It was never proven. And there was never a claim that they were competitors. I guess from 10,000 feet, perhaps. I mean, Peaceful Lodge was the evacuation partner of her sister's facility.
Right, but that's a far cry from it seems that you're trying to establish some nefarious connections between the parties and, you know, pointing to another facility being a part of the evacuation plan. That's simply backup. I guess one of the concerns I have is, where are the facts, even looking at them in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, that show the mere fact that there's some relationship that leads to the tortious interference, that leads to the misappropriation of trade secrets, that leads to all the claims that are alleged?
Yeah. All right. So without getting in all the details, from a trial perspective, the record indicates a number of instances where the parties testified in a contradictory fashion to the others. And that goes to credibility. I'm going to answer your question. I understand. And I think that familial relationship, while there may be competition, practically speaking, I don't know that one sister is going to bite off the hand of the other, for lack of a better term. Okay? What with respect to Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge, the evidence showed that, and that Li Vang told her sister that she and her husband had sold the business, that they got $17 million for the business, that Bao Vang,
just be clear, $17 million, you know, the majority of that was for the land. A small portion was for the actual business as a going concern.
On paper, but I think for tax reasons and the way that the corporate lawyers, and I'm not a corporate lawyer, structured these deals, I would submit that the operations and the land itself were sold to my clients. The purchase price was divided as such for accounting and tax reasons. But I think practically speaking, it's a $17 million sale.
Well, from a corporate perspective, it's looked at very differently, but go ahead.
Yes. But to answer your question, Aaron, it's a good question. You asked about the notice to Bao Vang, and as the law says, it's either actual or facts that would put a reasonable person on inquiry.
Right, but it has to be notice of the terms of the contract and the responsibilities underneath that. Let me switch gears real
sure.
quick, because there's an issue that I have of concern, and I want to move to the last issue of the trade secret misappropriation.
Yes.
And so putting aside the second part of the showing that there is an improper acquisition, which kind of goes to, you know, our discussion of credibility and who did what. But looking at the existence of a trade secret, in order for it to be established as a trade secret, there are three elements of that, at least three elements. And one is that it has to be information that's not generally known or reasonably ascertainable through proper means.
Yes.
How does the customer list in this case qualify and meet that? What are the facts that have been presented to show that it is not generally known by others when, I mean, you can just, you know, Google names and find people. It's not that hard to find people anymore. There's a very small, finite number of people here that are at the residence compared to, you know, other cases where they've said, okay, yeah, a customer list qualifies if you've got 10,000 names. Mm-hmm. But here it's only the name and the contact information that's alleged to be part of the customer list that's a trade secret. What is the information in the record that supports that that actually is a trade secret?
Well, okay, the if you take a look at HIPAA and the personal health information, under federal law, there are 18 identifiers that the federal statute says constitutes personal health information.
I understand HIPAA, but I'm not sure HIPAA really applies here, because what we're talking about is whether or not that information could be reasonably ascertainable by others.
Right. First of all, and I will get off HIPAA because I do think HIPAA is important, and there was evidence on the record that the resident list characterization is shorthand and is a term of art for the other information that is contained here. Your Honor, the district court, I think the line you're going down is accepted an argument that you can go to the white pages, or in your case, you can Google a name, and you can find a name. But once you Google that name, it doesn't give you the address or necessarily that person is a resident of a senior care facility.
Well, if you Google a person's name and the list, the address that's given is the resident, that residence, then you know that that's where they are.
In that hypothetical, I agree. But there's nothing on the record to indicate that the Sunlight Senior Living Facility is the address that appears if one were to Google or look up in the white pages a particular name.
So let me just rephrase the question then. What evidence did you present to show that there's an issue of material fact of there being a trade secret? I guess that maybe that's my question.
The issue came through predominantly Raquel Ettery, who manages the facility, that the names and the information associated with their names, their care plans and what have you, are maintained confidentially on what's called their RTASC system, that the RTASC system can only be searched for a valid business purpose by employees.
But that goes to the second element of what reasonable steps are taken. I'm asking about the first element of how does a resident list qualify as a trade secret in the first instance by not being generally known or reasonably ascertainable by proper means.
I apologize if I wasn't more clear, Your Honor. As is on the record, the resident list is a term of art. It's not just the name, and this is on the record. It is the care plan. It is the current condition of the resident and therefore what care is required. And I think that if you look at the record in this case, those residents that we contend were solicited away were all within in a condition that fit the type of care that either Sunlight Services or Peaceful Lodge was capable of providing. For example, in the piece...
I'm sorry.
No, Your Honor, go ahead.
Yeah. Just given the limited time, I do have one follow-up question on this, and then I do want to go back with a question on the tortious interference, if
sure.
I may. One, assuming that this was confidential information, where is there any evidence that was presented of misappropriation of the resident list beyond the fact that five, depending on how you count it, three to five residents moved, and actions of Sue Lee, who I understand is no longer, you know, a part of this lawsuit? Any evidence of misappropriation beyond those things on the record?
On the record, if you exclude Sue Lee and her accessing the system after resigning, going to work for Peaceful, no.
Okay,
there isn't.
Going back to my tortious interference question, so it seems to me a big issue in this case is whether Minnesota law, when we're looking at constructive knowledge, requires constructive knowledge of the contract or constructive knowledge of the specific provisions, here the restrictive covenants. You know, and yet when I looked at both the briefs, but especially yours, I just, in your reply brief, I just saw a lot of cites to cases from other jurisdictions. So what's the best Minnesota case you can point us to say, you know, from your perspective, I take it, it's more just general knowledge, hey, sold for $17 million was enough to put someone on that, fulfill that
I think it's more than just $17 million. I mean, I'm going to answer your question, but Balvang testified in her deposition, and I took her deposition. She is a sophisticated business person, that she was aware that in transactions like this, it is likely that there is a written agreement and that it's not uncommon for these type of agreements to have restrictive covenants. To answer your question, though, we start out with the restatement of torts, which indicates, and we've cited that in our reply brief, which indicates that you need to have knowledge, and again, actual or constructive, of the existence of the contract.
And has that provision of the restatement been adopted by any? I'm trying to just go back to what's the Minnesota case precedent that we should be looking at here?
I think it's by implication from the cases that we cited, like a Kallet case, or even a Cherney case, where they're not on all fours.
But doesn't that go to whether the information's, Cherney talked about what's a customer list. I'm trying to, and I'm trying to talk about tortious interference here, and whether it's actual constructive knowledge is, that's met if it's knowledge of the general contract and generally what they have, as opposed to here, and here this seller affiliate provision did seem more than just your generic restrictive covenant.
Right. So let me answer your question. And Kallet says this, and I will quote directly from it, and while it is not what the decision was based on, because Kallet was looking at justification, what Kallet said, and I'm quoting from it at page 362, tortious interference is not justified when a plaintiff demonstrates that the defendant had knowledge of facts which, if followed by reasonable inquiry, would have led to a complete disclosure of the contractual relationships and rights of the party. So what Kallet is saying is, if you have enough facts that would put you on inquiry to lead to the other facts, we're going to find that you had sufficient knowledge that the restrictive covenant existed and what type of information the restrictive covenant applied to answer your question. So Kallet's on all fours, even though it's addressing the justification issue in that case. But it doesn't detract from the holding that I just cited to the court. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you. So we will turn to counsel for respondent, and just again, remember to state your name and which of the respondents you're representing. And you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court. My name is Michelle Keel, and I'm representing respondents Cy Thao, Lee Vang, Sunlight Senior Living, Inc., and Sunlight Investments, Inc. First, as to Cy Thao, there's been no argument as to him in the briefing. Actually, there's a section in appellant's brief entitled Lee Vang's Personal Liability, but no similar discussion as to Cy Thao. So at this point, any argument as to him has been waived, and we would ask that summary judgment be affirmed as to him on that basis. As to Lee Vang, the first claim is breach of contract, and here that claim fails first and foremost because Lee Vang is not a party to the contract. And here I want to emphasize that there's a difference between being a seller affiliate and being personally liable on the contract, and appellant knows this because it didn't bring a breach of contract claim against the other alleged seller affiliates. And it's the natural result of how they chose to structure this contract. They chose to structure it as a contract between the two corporations. So the corporation is stating that seller affiliates will not do certain actions, and if the seller affiliates do, it's only the corporation that can be liable, not Lee Vang. Also, as to Lee Vang, there's a lack of consideration. And here, again, the corporate form matters. There is no authority for the argument in appellant's reply brief that consideration paid to a closely held corporation can somehow be considered consideration paid to the shareholders. And in fact, I would note that in the Otto versus Weber case that we've relied upon, that case involved a husband and wife closely held corporation, and the court held that the non-compete agreement did not apply to the shareholders individually. And so the same result should occur here. As to the issue of breach, appellant's argument relies on an assertion that there's an implicit duty to inform the others about the contract, but there is no such duty in the contract. You can look at the plain language of the whole contract, and there's no such duty, and this court does not read in duties and terms into contracts that are not there. Even if there was, the other defendants in this case are not seller affiliates. As to Bauvang, if you construe the contract as a whole, it's clear that if she was a seller affiliate, she would have had to shut down her business entirely, and that was not intended by the parties because they needed her to remain open, to remain an evacuation partner.
I mean, that seems pretty factual in nature. I mean, to get to that level, you know, is that what you're urging us to do? Or to, you know, and I'm also, I must say, I'm hesitant, and maybe one of your colleagues will address this, to say that to have to dive into who's immediate family and who's not under the contract.
Well, the interpretation of the contract terms is a question of law, and it's not a fact dispute as to the fact that they're siblings. So I don't think, so whether that siblings rises to immediate family member, I don't think is a factual question for the jury to decide when it's an interpretation of the contract. And also, I would say, again, if you construe the contract as a whole, as courts do, she can't be a seller affiliate because that would have required her to shut down her business entirely, and even Michael Ettery said that would have been a crazy interpretation. Sunlight Services, the connection is even more attenuated. They can't be a seller affiliate because there's no control by Lee Vang or Cy Thao. The Vang family trust that they rely upon has a lease and that really doesn't control the operation of their business at all. So for all those reasons, the breach of contract claim was properly dismissed. I'll touch on the misappropriation of trade secrets briefly. Here there's been no argument that Lee Vang or Cy Thao personally misappropriated anything, so the claim against them should be dismissed for that reason. And then also, even if there was, this information is not a trade secret. It's names and contact information that's generally known to at least the caseworkers and others
Is there anything in this record that would tell us whether this assisted living facility was locked to you or it was locked or, you know, with limited access? I'm just kind of given what the district court said, I'm wondering, you know, is there something in the record that says whether someone could have just walked down the hall and seen the names on the door?
I don't believe that information is in the record.
So it's not in the record whether there was limited access or not?
I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you.
And I see my time has expired, so I would just respectfully request that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. We'll hear from the next counsel for respondents. The clock has been reset, and you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Jeff Justman on behalf of Bauvang and the facility that she owns and operates, Peaceful Lodge, Inc. I want to start by answering Judge Jessen's question on the tortious interference claim and specifically constructive notice. The best case on that is Casino Resorts. It's cited in the briefing. It's a case from this court from 1997. There was a tortious interference claim. A party called CRC was said to be on notice of a letter of intent. That party was given a report that highlighted the name of the entity that should have been flagged for the letter of intent. This court affirmed summary judgment and said there's no constructive notice on those facts. The factual record is even weaker here. Typical constructive notice cases have at least one of three different facts, all of which are absent here. So the face of the agreement sometimes says non-disclosure agreement, non-compete agreement. This agreement just says purchase agreement. The second, Judge Jessen, you were reacting to that. Okay. The second factor sometimes present is someone tells them, hey, there may be an agreement here. You know, that was present in Colic, which counsel referenced. Colic is an actual notice case. It's not a constructive notice case. The third factor that's present is someone in their own experience says, hey, there's restrictive covenants in my experience in this industry, in this business. That was President Pampered Chef, and Pampered Chef still granted summary judgment to the party accused of tortious interference. Respectfully, opposing counsel isn't accurate to say that Balvang testified that it's not uncommon to have restrictive covenants. She testified exactly the opposite. Page 103 of her deposition transcript, that's docket 87, exhibit D, page 103, she said, I've never encountered these restrictive covenants in any time I've ever sold any of my businesses. She said she's generally familiar with the concept of a restrictive covenant, but she's never seen them in these types of sales. And there's no evidence of any expert or anyone else that says, yes, when you sell a restricted, when you sell an assisted living facility, it's quite common to include restrictive covenants. So under casino resorts or any of the other out-of-state cases that we cite on constructive notice, the district court's dismissal of the tortious interference claim should be affirmed. To answer one of the implications, I think, Judge Justin, one of your questions, all of the cases we cite apply Section 766 of the restatement. Minnesota courts have regularly adopted that. The buyer, I don't think, disputes that the standard in Section 766 applies. It's just, you know, on this record, you know, the parties take differing positions, and we've explained why. There's no fact dispute. There's no knowledge of that. And to address sort of the other piece that opposing counsel brought up after the litigation was filed, there was one resident that transferred. The undisputed record for that one resident is that that resident's family reached out to Peaceful Lodge, not the other way around. There was no solicitation. That's at Balvang's deposition transcript at page 123 through 128. So you can't have any improper solicitation when the resident transfers, and the record shows that the resident's family member wanted that resident to be closer to him in Hudson, Wisconsin.
Is there any evidence of solicitation of employees, because it's not just residents?
On the employee issue, that's easy. At pages 85 to 86 of Mr. Edery's deposition transcript, he says, we're not seeking any damages for any employees. So whether or not they were solicited, there can be no damages. So any claim related to employees is out for that basic reason. Similarly, their expert report, which is in the record at Exhibit E to docket 87, doesn't identify any damages for any employees that were allegedly solicited. Turning to the misappropriation claim, I heard opposing counsel say that the resident list included care plans and other medical information. That's not in the complaint. Paragraphs 93 and 95 of the complaint don't reference resident lists. They only reference contact information and resident names. And more importantly, the resident list isn't in the record. The plaintiff has the burden of proving trade secrets with specificity. There is no document that says, this is the resident list, here are their names, here are their contact information, here are their medical conditions, or any other information.
Well, generally, you don't put the alleged trade secret in the document itself. You reference it and you provide a non-confidential summary of what that document is.
Yeah, so, I mean, opposing counsel can point to it in the record. There's not even sort of a summary of that. And more to the point, the district court dismissed it on the pleadings. There's nothing in the pleadings that says resident list, or excuse me, care plan or any medical information. And the issue was fully briefed on summary judgment, and there's certainly no fact dispute about, hey, this is what the care plan, you know, the court can ask opposing counsel, where's the care plan in the record? Point to me to the page. I'd be curious to hear what the answer to that is.
So you said there's no care plan. What else did you say was not?
Any of the medical information, the HIPAA information, that's a distraction. That wasn't in the pleadings, and that's not in the record. So just to conclude on this, Your Honors, you can't tortiously interfere with a contract that you don't know about, and the district court was correct to dismiss the case for that reason, among numerous reasons, and we'd ask that the district court's judgment in favor of our clients, Balvang and Peaceful Lodge, be affirmed.
Thank you. And your time has expired as well. And we will hear from last of the counsel for respondents now. The clock has been reset, and you can begin when you're ready.
Hey, police to court. My name is Roger Yang, counsel for Sunlight Services. So something that opposing counsel said kind of really caught my interest, saying that this should be a jury issue. There are facts in dispute. Well, actually, there are not facts in dispute. There is no fact tying my client to anything that is going on in this case. She bought, or my client, there's nothing connecting Sunlight Services to anything in this case. They have submitted a bunch of red herrings, like an unfounded website, a provision in the contract, in the sales agreement that is in a lease that is present in many different types of leases. The fact that she operates and that Sunlight Services operates in the same industry as their client, none of these facts could be read from a jury to say, oh, you knew about this contract, you were controlled by Balvang, you had anything to do with this case at all. Years ago in 2014, Curvu bought a facility from Li Vang. Li Vang consulted with them. That's essentially the end of their relationship. They had a lease with the Vang Family Trust that wasn't with Li or Bao. Now, so it's sort of bewildering that my client is still even in this case at all. They have nothing to do with it, and we've been clear from the start that we've had nothing to do with this case.
What about the trade secrets claims? Because as I understand it, two of those maybe moved somewhere else first, but you know there were four of these 60 residents that ended up moving after the purchase agreement was signed.
So on the trade secrets claim, there's no... So they're trying to say that Sunlight Services took information from Su Li, who Su Li's employment with Sunlight Services ended soon after they purchased it. Su Li has not been involved with Sunlight Services in many years, and there's no evidence of the actual misappropriation, anything like that. With regards to the individual residents, I would in our brief we detail it. My Vang discussed what the circumstances were for each of these persons coming to Sunlight Services. It all had to do with case managers. One person even came before the purchase of Sunlight Services by Curvu, or they agreed to come before that even the purchase even happened. The other ones, it was family members, it was case managers, no solicitation, and no taking of information. There's nothing in the record about any relationship between Su Li and Sunlight Services. I do want to address Rule 56, or affidavits, the Rule 56 affidavit. Opposing counsel stated that the district court has a lot of errors in its decision. Well, I would like to point out some errors in opposing counsel's brief, and I want to make this clear for the court. There were two affidavits. One was filed in July of 2021. The other one was filed in September. Because they have an issue of the September affidavit coming far too long after Sunlight Services' summary judgment motion was heard, what we have here is they are constantly citing the July 2021 affidavit for statements that were made in the September 2021 affidavit. And their arguments are all about the September 2021 affidavit. I want to make that clear for the court that these are different affidavits. The arguments are about the September 2021 affidavit. That one was filed 42 days after the hearing on Sunlight Services' summary judgment motion. The case law is clear from the Court of Appeals in McDonald that is far too late, that this court no longer has jurisdiction over that because they did not bring it in time. And I want to take my last 30 seconds to just talk about sort of the fact that the court could still affirm by looking at the entire record. And I want to focus on the fact that, going back to the beginning, my client had nothing to do with this case. Sunlight Services, Curvu, nothing to do with this case at all. And yet, on page 31 of the opposing counsel's brief, they are still trying to make statements that are unfounded. They say, we couldn't depose Curvu until deposing Mai Vang and other family members that Sunlight Services Senior Living became aware of Curvu possessed knowledge. What family members? None of my Vang's family members were deposed.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired as well. So thank you for the counsel from the respondents. And counsel for the appellant, we'll turn to you for the last word. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Sure. Please begin when you're ready.
Let me work backwards. We heard from Sunlight Services lawyer that Curvoo had nothing to do with this. That's why the Rule 5604 motion was so important. The first one was brought in July. It was renewed in September. The district court never ruled on it. In the August hearing, the district court, Her Honor, said it, the owner of Sunlight Services likely has relevant information. Drop the ball.
Didn't the district court address that when she granted the motion to quash?
She didn't really address it. She just granted the motion.
Because it was like, you know, they brought a motion to quash, you brought a motion for...
We had, because we were told, the counsel were instructed by the district court in the August hearing that the district court was of the belief that Curvoo may very well have relevant information. Told the parties to work it out, find a date. The response was, if you want to take Curvoo's deposition, here's our conditions. 2 hours, including breaks. You pay for all of the defendant's lawyer's time. You pay for the translator, which we agreed to ahead of time, and you pay for all the transcripts for all of defense counsel. Those are our conditions. If you don't agree to those conditions, we're not going to produce. So then we filed and served a subpoena. Then the motion to quash. And in Her Honor's September order, the motion to quash was granted. There was little, if any, discussion. The 5604 motion was never considered, let alone the Maple Grove factors were never considered. Now, it has been argued that it is permissive for a district court as to whether or not it's even going to hear and rule on the motion. 5604, to the degree it's permissive, says the district court may, and then there's three items that the district court may order in response to a 5604 motion, not that the district court can ignore the motion. Now, with respect to Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge, the argument with respect to the casino case, there's no actual knowledge. With respect to that, those parties alone, Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge, it's important, I believe, to recognize and step back that the resident that did leave left after the lawsuit was started. The complaint recites that there's a purchase and sale agreement. The complaint quotes directly the restrictive covenants in the purchase and sale agreement that was served. And Her Honor below said the complaint doesn't constitute notice, period, with a citation to any authority.
Okay. Setting notice, assuming that was notice, though, there still has to be some evidence of solicitation, right?
Through Sue Lee.
But why? But Sue Lee's no longer a defendant in this lawsuit.
But she's an agent of Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge. She goes to work for them. She accepted a job and was working there prior to what we have contended is the solicitation and prior to the actual move. She's an employee of the defendant, Peaceful Lodge. So there's notice. In fact, the record shows that when that one memory care unit transferred from my client's facility to Peaceful Lodge, Peaceful Lodge's head nurse went to Bao Vang and in sum and substance, I don't want to be misquoted because I don't remember specifically what the quote was, what effect is this going to have on the litigation? So not only did Bao Vang and Peaceful Lodge know what was going on, apparently at least a portion of her staff did, had notice of what was being alleged, including the solicitations and the restrictive covenants. Now, I want to talk about, real briefly, because I got 50 seconds, on the breach of contract against Lee Bang. Okay. If you take the argument to its logical conclusion, Lee Bang could have, the day of the closing or the day thereafter, set up a competing facility right next door to the facility that she had just sold. That's the logical conclusion of the argument and of the district court's opinion. That's what would happen. And in closing, I just want to say, We have never argued that the seller affiliates are bound by the restrictive covenants in the purchase and sale agreement. Our argument is that the sellers haven't taken on these obligations, not only for the sellers, but the seller affiliates in their contract. They had a contractual obligation to ensure that their affiliates, at a minimum, knew of the provisions of this, and secondarily, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, took on liability for their affiliates' breach of those restrictive covenants as contracting parties.
Judge Wheelock, if I may ask a
Yes, please question. Do.
Thank you. I want to go back to this, your second to last argument.
Yeah.
Of leaving, opening up a facility right next door.
Yes.
Are you assuming that she qualifies as an immediate family member?
No, Your Honor. She clearly is a seller affiliate under the purchase and sale agreement because specifically, we're not in the family member. It's Lee Vang, one of the owners of the seller defendants.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. We've never claimed that the others were bound by those restrictive covenants, but the sellers, and in our view, Lee Vang and our allegations, Cy Tao, even though we didn't assert that, were contractually liable because they assumed that contractual risk.
Okay, so you're saying with Lee Vang with respect to in her individual capacity?
Yes, sir. Both the sellers and in her individual capacity for the reasons that we had argued in our briefs that she does have personal liability. If there's no more questions, I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And thank you to all of counsel and all of the parties who are here today. We will take this matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. And with that, that ends this morning's oral arguments scheduled here in courtroom 200. The court is in recess as we transition to our single argument, remaining one